Good afternoon. Call to order the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water for Thursday, April 14th. We have a very full agenda. If I look like someone with two young children and a sick wife and disturbed cats at home, because I am someone with two young children, a sick wife, and disturbed cats at home. So I hope you will be patient with me as I am impatient with you. We are going to try to get out of here by 5, even despite the length of our agenda. We're going to free things up right here at the start by carrying over some work sessions for Tuesday. So I'm going to read those carryovers now. We're going to carry over, hopefully you have your scorecards out, we're going to carry over the possible work session on House Bill 3325. We don't have paperwork still on that. We're going to carry over the possible work session on House Bill 3121, missing paperwork on that. Carry over the work session on House Bill 3597, also paperwork. We're going to carry over the work session, possible work session on House Bill 2009. We're going to carry over the possible works. I'll hold off on that for a moment, in case we do decide to get there. We're going to carry over the possible work session on House Bill 2735. We're going to carry over the possible work session on House Bill 2873. Same carryover on possible work session for 3165. And a carryover on the possible work session for House Bill 3451. We will not be hearing House Bill 2867 today. We will not be opening the work session on that. So our plan is to begin with our public hearings on House Bills 2006, 2134, 3342, and 3623. Any other bill that I haven't mentioned, we will try to get to with a work session by before 5 o'clock. So at this time, I'm going to try to take them in order. Well, I see Representative Freeman here. Let's begin with his bill then. We'll start with a public hearing on House Bill 3342. So Representative Freeman. Madam Administrator, would you like to introduce this bill? Thank you, Representative. I forget constantly. I was trained by my co-chair to forget.
I accept that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3342 would require any wholesale dealer of gasoline to sell gasoline containing 10% ethanol by volume and gasoline not blended with ethanol having an octane rating of 91 or above.
Thank you, Co-Chair Cannon and Co-Chair Gilliam. For the record, my name is Tim Freeman. I am a House representative of House District 2 down in the Roseburg area, and actually today I'm wearing two hats. I'm also a retail service station owner. This is a simple bill that probably won't end up being very simple. Last session, the ones of you that looks like all of you are here, helped me pass a little piece of legislation through the legislature. It turned out to be a vote of 89-1 that passed through both sides of the House and the Senate and signed by the governor that allowed service stations to offer for sale. I didn't require it, but allowed service stations to offer for sale unblended, non-ethanol, 91 or above octane fuel. It simply was a bill to allow some access for certain types of vehicles and certain types of industry.
There's some question whether you actually said your name. Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chair. There was a question on
thank you.
He identified as.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam. I am Tim Freeman, State Representative, House District 2, service station owner from Roseburg. Again, my name is Tim Freeman. For all those that weren't paying attention.
I think he got it the third time.
Trying to be clear, but I'm also trying to be concise. I was warned I had just a very little bit of time.
You used it up.
Did we stop the clock while that was going on? Okay. So we did pass that bill. And at the time we passed that bill, this product was widely available in Oregon and very easy to access. And again, it was for some niche markets around the state, including marine type markets. Some of the logging equipment, especially chainsaws, did not run well at all, and a few other types of vehicles. That everything was fine. We passed that law, and 30 days before the law took effect, a group of suppliers, corporate oil companies, got together and decided they didn't want to continue to supply that product. So 30 days before we could start offering that product for sale, the big oil companies said, you know what, we're not going to mess with that, and quit supplying the product. So this bill simply says, you know what, that ain't right. You know what our intent was. We would like you to offer that product for sale. You're going to hear, depending on who testifies, that's not available, we can't do it, nobody's producing it. All those things are untrue. Currently, unbranded stations throughout Oregon have access to this fuel readily. There is access to this fuel in Vancouver, Washington, just across the border, and it is being sold around the state. It simply is that the big oil companies have decided they don't want to fill this niche market. This would ask them, require them to do that. My suggestion is they could do it in several different ways, including through a contract. I tried to make that happen through a contract and was told that they didn't have to and they weren't going to. That's all I'm trying to do here. Again, it's a simple technical fix to something we did last time.
Thank you, Representative Freeman. I'm actually very happy to give you additional time. No one else has signed up to testify. Perhaps you'd like to do more of that, anticipating opponents' arguments and then rebutting them, since we're not hearing from opponents.
Okay. I can. again, they'll say that nobody's making the product and that it's hard to distribute and it would require extra tanks and a huge amount of cost. I disagree. I think it through contract it could be supplied very easily. The bill does not require any sort of a price point or a match of ethanol blended fuel. And I do believe through contract, if this was in place, every supplier in Oregon could offer for sale this product to anybody that wanted to purchase it. And it would fill the need of those niche markets, including the boating market that I know at least one of the co-vice chair's husband would love to have in place.
Let's limit the universe. Are there questions? Representative Krieger.
Representative Freeman, you mentioned saws. I talk about yard tools, cement mixers, ATVs, lawnmowers, every small engine there is. Have you ever heard of it? Has anyone ever looked at the tens of thousands of miles people have been traveling to and from repair shops to get these things fixed? You got to take it in and go home. Then you got to go get it and take it home. So it's four trips from your house to wherever you're going. And how much fuel are we burning up that we think we're going to be saving with ethanol?
Thank you, Representative Krieger, Co-Chair Cannon. I want to be careful here because I'm not opposed to people burning fuel. That on the record. Matter of fact, if you're getting too good of fuel mileage, we can let air out of your tires and we can fix that. That being said, there is certain types of engines that are not designed to run ethanol fuel. And you mentioned a few, I would add a couple to that. A lot of the equipment that's on emergency response vehicles is probably one of the more important ones. I would tell you some of those that are out in the river, when the river's up and running and there's some safety issues around making sure your boat runs right, those that go out on the ocean. So as much as we want our weed eaters, lawnmowers, ATVs, all that stuff, there is a greater concern in access to this fuel. I'm not here today to revisit the idea of eliminating ethanol blend. I'm just simply saying that we need to have access throughout Oregon for this product in those areas that there is a market for them.
Thank you.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The definition of wholesale dealer, is that of any concern at all?
Thank you, Representative Benz. It's not of any concern to me. It may be of concern to them, and I would tell you that the discussion that I just had about through contract, I think it is implied. It may need to be, I mean, I think we're having that talk right now, so there'll be some legislative clarity around that. The word, the way it's stated, you know, to offer for sale does not imply that they have to have a tank full of it. They just have to have it for sale. So through contract, they can offer it for sale, in my opinion. We could, of course, get a legal definition of that. But it's not my intent to require every wholesaler in the state of Oregon to put another tank in to have this product. It is my intent that those people that are wholesalers that have contracts with retail stations around the state of Oregon find a way to offer this product for sale.
Follow-up. I was just concerned about some relatively small wholesaler dealer suddenly having to make sure this is offered, but I don't know of any small wholesale dealers, to be honest with you, so I was just curious if there are such folk.
Representative Benz, thank you. There are small folk, and again, I think that this is such a small niche market that there will be some wholesalers that choose to carry this product and offer it for sale directly. The vast majority will choose to figure out a way to contract it. There's trucks running all over the place. And since we're not fixing a price or saying there's going to be a price point or a comparison to another product, the contract can spell out those things. What I am saying is that currently there's no requirement for them to even enter into that contract, and they have chose not to. And this would require them to offer it for sale.
Thank you.
Seeing nothing further, I'm going to invite Paul Romain, who did signal now that he is interested, despite not signing up. He must have said something.
Would you like to sit with me, or would you like to sit with me?
I would love to sit with you.
Thank you.
What did you say your name was?
We're running short on time.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain. I'm an attorney in Portland with the Romain Group, and I represent the Oregon Petroleum Association. And the dilemma that Representative Freeman is in is that the fuel is available. There's 91 Clear up in Vancouver that's available for folks to truck down. It's that he has a contract with his oil company that will not allow him to have the product at his station. It's not availability of the product. That's the issue. And that we discussed the bill as it's currently written, we have a little bit of heartburn with, because it seems to mandate that we carry the product. But his concern is that he should be able to allow the sale of the product at his branded station, and he is unable to do so. And that is an issue between Representative Freeman and his whoever brands him, basically the oil company. And I know Representative Cannon is taking great glee in the conference. No, nothing. Thank you. I just wanted to explain.
Beginning to get interesting. Representative Posen.
I hear what you're saying, but wouldn't an approval of a law like this induce whoever he's contracting with to get on board?
Mr. Co-Chair's Representative Thompson, the problem with the bill as it's currently written is it sort of takes a sledgehammer when a little ball pin hammer, whatever they're called, would be more appropriate. You basically need the issue is between the station owner and whoever he's getting his product from, and that's, I believe, Shell. And if he needs any kind of relief, that would be where the legislation should point, not to what we see in the legislation as mandating that we carry this fuel. It's available in pretty much any distributor. We'll get it for you if you can put it in.
If there are no further questions, I'm going to let Representative Freeman get the final word here.
And Mr. Romaine's partly right. Okay. The fact is the bill says offer for sale. It doesn't say carry. It doesn't require anybody to have product on site. It says offer for sale. It's not about me and my station. It is about no branded stations in Oregon can get this product and sell it under their canopy. Okay, so it's not about my contract with my supplier. My supplier cannot get it from the oil company. They cannot get Shell-branded product from the oil company. This would say they have to be able to get it through at least a contract. And it says offer it for sale. It does not say carry it. I mean, I was very careful to write it that way. I think this allows them both to carry it if they choose to in a tank themselves, or they can offer it through a contract.
Great. Well, thank you very much for bringing the bill, Representative Freeman. I glad to see you bringing mandate bills to this House. I look forward to more. And we'll
more to
come. More to come. Very good. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3342. We're going to carry over the possible work session on House Bill 3342. Again, no paperwork or not enough paperwork yet on this to be able to move it forward. We're going to move. We'll carry it over to Tuesday. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2006. Representative, you're very welcome here, Representative Jensen, and anyone you wish to bring with you, or start on your own, and we'll bring them up next. We have a list of folks who have signed up to testify on this bill. Liz, do you want to give us the introduction?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2006 provides that for purposes of the Renewable Portfolio Standard, electric utilities will be classified as small electric utilities so long as they sell to 25,000 or fewer customers, serve retail customers in Umatilla, Morrow, or Union County, and that they are a member of the Boardman Impacted Facility. It also establishes a Boardman Plant Closure Impact Fund with the potential to fund that fund through lottery proceeds.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, co-chairs Cannon and Gilliam, and members of the committee. My name is Bob Jensen, state representative from House District 58, and I'm here to introduce Mr. Eldridge and another gentleman who's probably a very stranger around the building that most of you have never seen before, but he'll have some very good information for you, too. Very, very briefly, Umatilla Electric Co-op is a relatively small electric co-op in serving customers in Umatilla, Morrow County, and as such is facing a kind of unique situation. Unique situation is that a new large load server farm, RE namely Amazon, is proposing to build or will build three different server sites in the Umatilla Electric Co-op service territory. The server farm requires very heavy loads with relatively low employment potential in the area. The new load will put Umatilla Electric Co-op over the 3% baseline and into a large load category utility, for the RPS. This in itself is sufficient to be something of a major problem and concern for them, but it also happens to be accompanying a time that there's going to be some additional loss of some fairly significant, substantial jobs and industry in the area, one of which is the Boardman coal-fired plant will be decommissioned down the road very shortly here, and that will result in the loss of a number of jobs. And another one of the things is areas is the Umatilla chemical depot will be closing down in just a few years. Now, that, of course, is good. That is good for Oregon. It's good for the people in Umatilla County. It's good for, you know, everybody, because we're removing one of the very significant hazardous wastes, you know, from our environment. And it will be well when that is over and done. But the economic cost is going to be significant. At any rate, without trying to get into and understand all of the complexities of this, I will leave that to Steve and Mr. Eldridge and others, and just ask for your favorable consideration as they present this case to you. And I wish that, thank you very much for your time and cooperation.
Thanks, Representative Jensen. Mr. Eldridge.
Thank you. My name is Steve Eldridge. I'm the general manager of Umatilla Electric Cooperative and headquartered in Hermiston, Oregon. And what I'm going to endeavor to do today is to lay out how we got to where we're at, why we think our request is reasonable, and ask for your support. But a little bit about Umatilla Electric, because it's very important that the committee know that we're not like Portland General Electric. We're an electric cooperative. We don't own generation. We're nonprofit distribution. The owners and customers are one and the same. Statutorily, we are required to serve any electrical load that comes into our service territory on a non-discriminatory basis. And we operate in accordance with cooperative principles. And you add that all up, and what that means is that when a load like Amazon comes to us, first of all, we don't go out and recruit large customers. In our neck of the woods, it's the state and the port districts are the main economic development engines. So they bring a load in, our new customer, and then they come to us and ask us to put in the last piece. They've made their deal, whether it's tax abatement, property, or whatever, and we tell them what the power is going to cost. And that's the situation that we're in here. So as a cooperative, there are no cross-subsidizations between different rate classes. Everyone has to pay their fair share of the cost to provide service and the margins that we use for our operating capital. So in 2008, this customer showed up and said that they wanted one and a half times, a load equivalent to one and a half times Umatilla's size in 2008. They wanted a triple redundancy site, one large installation. Started building, tended to have one-third of their needs online within 2 years, and then by November, all activity stopped, and we lived through the recession now that we hope's over. In March of last year, activity restarted, only now there were three sites, and we ended up with two in Boardman and one in Umatilla. And while it's a little unclear to me exactly what these three sites will be, because there's so many new business lines that they're offering, things like cloud computing, it's hard to know exactly how this is going to come together. But normally, a data center site's about 40 average megawatts. So if there are three, then we could be back into well over 100 megawatts of electrical needs. Construction is ongoing at all three sites as we speak. We have a signed supply agreement. And we believe by 2014, if not earlier, we will be at 3% above the retail sales in the state of Oregon. And this will put us in the 25% RPS, where we are currently at 10%. And by following the schedule as outlined by the Oregon Department of Energy of how this would play out once we go above 3%, by 2033, the people of Umatilla and Morrill County will pay $36 million in additional cost from the difference of being at a 10% RPS and a 25%. Well, so you may be thinking, well, why don't you wait until 2014? Now, there's a couple reasons for that. One is the last place you want to be is going to buy energy the day you need it. And secondly, by this September, we have to let Bonneville know what Tier 2 products we will be buying from 2015 to 2019. And then every rate period, you have to true up your forecasts and you have to true up your conditions. So every year, every month that goes by with this question unanswered, I have to be preparing for one of the two outcomes. So why are we doing this? Well, one is that by Oregon statute, we have to serve people on a non-discriminatory basis. As a cooperative, everybody pays their fair share, and while we're putting a rate schedule together in which load growth will be phased in so that the impacts aren't too great on existing customers, they eventually will pay the same rate as everybody else does. This is our opportunity in the digital economy. And we have kind of limited economic opportunities. What we are really good at is value-added irrigated ag. The state of Oregon has said no more summer water out of the Columbia, so that means no growth in that sector. We compete with an urban center in the Tri-Cities, 30 minutes away by interstate, 200,000 people. It's a very, very strong competitor for talent and for jobs. And our wages are 22% of what state averages are and where we live. We do not make special rate deals. Now, there's significant wind development in our area, as you may know. If you've driven to Hermiston recently, there's pretty much steady wind turbines once you leave the Dalles. But the main benefactors of this development locally are the people that own the land. Through the annual rents for line right-of-way, we have almost as many new transmission lines as we have turbines that we're dealing with. The wind developers are willing to pay $8 to $10 a running foot for line right-of-way. We normally don't pay for easements, so this is another economic impact. The other beneficiaries are firms like Iberdrola and Gamesa. And the people are here because of state subsidies and, of course, the federal subsidies. But more importantly, they're here because it's the cheapest place to integrate their energy. Our wonderful federal-based hydro system, which is now tapped out when it comes to integrating wind, has made all this possible. This massive overgeneration of wind will soon be firmed by natural gas, which is going to drive up the cost of this resource. On average, Umatilla Electric conserves 2% of its sales each year. And our strategy before Amazon showed up is that we felt through this aggressive conservation that we have that we could probably flatten our growth curve to the extent that we could avoid this 3% of state sales for a long period of time. Now, 2% is very good. In fact, you can ask our friend Ralph Cavana, who is co-director of NRDC, and he tells me that it's as good or better than any cooperative anywhere when it comes to conservation and energy efficiency. But that plan won't work now. Amazon, under the current RPS mandate, will require that all of our non-Tier 1, non-hydro resource, 70% of it will be large wind. That means that we cannot diversify our power supply. I've been at this for 40 years now, and I've seen this happen time after time of where, as a region, a state, and a country, we overinvest in a single technology for power supply. And then when we exhaust that, we have no diversification. So if natural gas prices, which are volatile, go up or down, the price yo-yos just with it, and we don't have any way to spread the risk. And not being able to diversify for our small company is a big deal. So, in summary, the RPS was aimed at utilities with generation or going to build generation. We do not have any generation. We are neither. The RPS was for emitting utilities, Umatilla Electric does not emit. The RPS was to encourage conservation and energy efficiency. Umatilla Electric is world-renowned for energy efficiency and water conservation. We're not asking to be exempted from the RPS, but rather that we have more time to deal with the eventual fact of being at 25%. And we don't think that adding the additional condition of at least 25,000 customers is unreasonable. And so we're asking that you pass our bill to help us manage the increased costs paid by the people in Oregon least able to pay it. And if we cannot pass our bill because you believe that the societal benefits are greater than the costs, well, then share the benefits with us and help us pay for it. A small change in this criteria cannot wreak the havoc that some say that it will. If that were true, we'd all be at 25% or higher now, wouldn't we? Two items distinguish Umatilla Electric from most, if not all, of you who you will hear from on this issue. One is Umatilla Electric does not financially benefit from the RPS. And secondly, we probably are the only ones here speaking for the people that pay the bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eldridge. Craig, if you could keep it brief. We'll...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here also on behalf of Umatilla Electric Cooperative. I'm going to briefly hit three issues, one of which is to describe the process by which the renewable portfolio standard kicks in once you go beyond the 3% threshold for retail sales. For a company like this that starts as a small company and then transitions in, there's a process by over a number of years you work into the portfolio requirements that a large utility has. So Umatilla Electric will be lagging behind that between about 5 and 8 years. So, but ultimately, it does have to get to that 25 percentile, and as Steve said, it's going to be around 2033. The second thing I wanted to talk to you about is the face of the individuals who will be impacted by not passing this bill. The people in the Umatilla, Morrow, and Union County areas where we serve are not wealthy folks. Morrow County, 71% of the students are eligible for reduced price meals. We have 15.7% of the population at the poverty level. For Umatilla, that's about 14%, and for Union, it's about 14.7%. For their energy costs to go up when they're not actually buying any more energy, as a result of a company like Umatilla Electric being treated as a large utility, and it really isn't if you look at it compared to the others, then what you're doing is you're putting a hardship on folks who not only have to deal with their current economic problems, but also the ones that will come down the pike when we lose over 500 of really our best-paying jobs in the area. By comparison, if you were going to translate that to, like, the Portland area, people have used a comparison of 150 jobs to one as a comparison for that region's job loss and Portland's job loss. That would translate to about 76,000 jobs lost in the Portland area as far as impact is concerned. The final thing I wanted to talk to you about is one thing that hasn't been mentioned, and that is the creation of the fund when the Boardman power plant is shut down. It will create a fund of about $4 million in lottery that can be used to offset property tax losses for counties, cities, loss in revenue to local businesses, and for job training and placement for those employees who will lose their job as a result of the closure of the Boardman power plant. And with that, I can certainly answer any questions you may have.
Great. See if there are questions from the committee. I have just one. As I recall, the RPS has off-ramps if price increases resulting from the purchase of renewables to meet the requirement exceed the cost of buying new power. Can you describe what, non-renewable power, can you describe what how that would impact and perhaps help minimize the cost increases associated with the 25% standard?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I may not be the best person to answer this question, but I'll give it a shot. There are basically two protections for an entity like Umatilla Electric when they pass that 3% threshold. One is that you cannot be forced to take a greater percentage than your non, what's the word I'm looking for? non-hydro power. That won't be the case here because right now Umatilla Electric's power from hydro is pretty much fixed. It's not going to be growing. So our demand from outside of that will continue to grow, so that protection really won't apply to us. The second one fixes your amount of increased cost by 4% per annum. But as we've mentioned before, this is going to be something that's going to grow over time. I don't know if there's a point where on any one given year for residential, as an example, we're going to cross above 4%, maybe once. So that protection isn't going to provide much help to our residential customers who are still going to have to face that ongoing increase until we reach 25% overall. I hope I answered the question correctly in what you were asking.
Sorry. Our forecasts are not anticipating that any number of years with the forecasted RPS cost and non-RPS cost will bring about us exiting. And even and if I understand it, and I may not, say it's 1 year and then you're back above and the rate increase, you know, do we just come in and out? It's not clear to me what the off-ramp, how it actually works.
Any other questions? So none will get next panel up. Thank you very much for being here. Let's bring up Greg Peden as well as Jeff Bissonette and Alan Tresseter. Greg, we'll start with you.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, I'm Greg Peden here representing ORECA, the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. ORECA represents 18 cooperatives around the state, roughly 200,000 members, mostly in rural and remote parts of Oregon, with over 30,000 miles of line. Appreciate the opportunity to comment on House Bill 2006 to allow Umatilla Electric Cooperative to remain in the 10% category under the RPS. We support this legislation and make a targeted revision to the RPS based on some extenuating circumstances in their community, as they've discussed. I want to make it clear that this will not lead to a stampede of electric cooperatives seeking exemptions from RPS, in case that is a concern of yours or others. Most of the electric cooperatives will never reach the 3% threshold that we've discussed here today. They have not the growth nor the infrastructure to take on large new loads. We are talking about cooperatives in places like Monument and Burns. If anything, growth is stagnant or negative in these rural communities. They are currently planning for 2025 when they will comply with the 5% mandate for the state's smallest utilities, and any implication that this will create a large loophole in the RPS is simply just not based on fact. Finally, I just want to reemphasize, as I think you've already heard, that based on the federal hydroelectric system, the emphasis on virtually zero emissions from that system existent throughout the cooperative system. That concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonette, representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition. The coalition is a statewide collaboration of consumer groups, environmental organizations, human service agencies, faith groups, clean energy businesses, and labor, all looking to develop forward-looking energy policy for the state. The coalition was a strong supporter of the Renewable Portfolio Standard. We come in opposition to House Bill 2006. I appreciate Mr. Campbell's testimony talking about how the RPS will be implemented. It saved me time from testifying to that because that was going to sort of provide the basis for my testimony. I think what we hear is the Umatilla Electric Co-op saying, give us time, but what the law provides now is time to to plan how they're going to meet the RPS. The RPS was put in place to determine how the state is going to meet its future load growth. We've had a lot of debate over, you know, what counts and the existing resources that do or don't count, and the answer that we have given consistently is we're looking at how we're going to meet load going forward. And if we have a large, industrial user, essentially, in terms of a server farm coming into the state driving load growth, then I think that we are committed to making sure that we have that load met with renewable resources up to 25% by the mid-2030s. I think that you heard testimony that I thought was dismissive about the consumer protections in the RPS, and it was actually those consumer protections that drove consumer organizations to support the RPS because it's not a 4% per annum, but it's whether particular resources that are required to meet the RPS, if they push above 4% of what other resources would otherwise be, a utility can invest up to that point and then stop and still be in compliance with the law, still be in compliance with the renewable portfolio standard. So I think that what we have here is a utility saying, we might go above if they, and the reason they're saying, they become subject to the law in 2016 is because, or maybe it's 2017, they had different numbers when I talked to them or when I saw information the other day. The once you go over that 3% of state load mark, you have to maintain that load for 3 consecutive years. If you don't, you're not subject to the full RPS. It's once you reach those full 3 years, then it's the next year that the standard kicks in, and then it's not until 4 years hence that you have to meet the first benchmark, which is 5%, and then another period of time until you meet the next benchmark, and then the next benchmark up to 25%. So the utility is asking for time. They have time. It was built in the time. Their ratepayers are protected the same way that ratepayers are protected, not only in Portland, but in Bend, in Roseburg, in Coos Bay, throughout the state. And so the same consumer protections that exist everywhere else in the state exist in the service territory of Umatilla Electric Co-op. I appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony. I'd be happy to answer questions at the appropriate time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Alan Trusseter, and I'm here representing Iberdrola Renewables. Iberdrola Renewables is one of the largest, if not the largest, renewable energy company in the world. We're a home company based in Spain, but U.S. headquarters is in Portland, Oregon. We've grown from about 30 employees to over 450 in a relatively brief period of time. And Iberdrola has invested $2 billion, that's with a B, billion, in Oregon since 2007. That is not an insignificant number that we've invested in the renewable energy structure of Oregon. We believe, we know that we did that for 3 reasons. Because the wind blows east of the mountains, because we had the business energy tax credit, and because we had the RPS. Those 3 reasons are what drove Iberdrola to invest very heavily in Oregon. And the RPS and the wind blowing are still very important reasons for the continued growth of renewable industry in Oregon. We're invested not only in wind farms, but we have some small solar projects, and we're building a very large biomass facility in Lakeview. And so I would urge you, we oppose this bill. We believe the RPS is probably one of the single most important energy policy decisions this legislature has ever made. It will urge all of us to look at renewable energy as an answer to growth load in the coming years. As Jeff has pointed out, Umatilla Electric has a number of years to decide whether they're actually going to go over this growth. We have plenty of time to revisit this issue if 6-7 years from now they appear to be in economic jeopardy. I they have a long time to plan for this. And so we would urge you to not let exceptions to the RPS standard. They apply to everyone. Umatilla knows what the thresholds are, as does every other renewable company and energy company in Oregon. So we would urge you to not go forward with this bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Helen. Any questions? Great. Thanks very much. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2006. So we're going to carry over the possible work session on House Bill 2006. Then we're going to stand at ease for a moment to bring someone in on phone for House Bill 2134. So that's where we're headed next, House Bill 2134. But for the moment, we'll stand at ease. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2134. Welcome back, Representative Jensen. And Liz, do you want to read the description of the bill?
Of course, if I can find it.
These snacks are getting out of control.
Not easy, is it?
No.
While we're waiting, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Maybe we could ask Representative Jensen if he misses our committee.
Not at all.
Mr. Co-Chair, on grounds that that might
prejudice the prejudice
whatever.
The
fill in the blank.
Liz, will you read the description of the bill?
Mr. Co-Chair, in all honesty, I not only miss the committee, but I miss the debates and scholarship that have always been known to this committee. So,
well, they deteriorated with your departure.
Okay.
Liz, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2134 would allow water exchange applications to be submitted where the applicant holds a permit for groundwater recharge. There is a -3 amendment before the committee, which would redefine the term of a person holding a water rights certificate or permit. It would also allow, allow that any such person to submit an application for exchange for groundwater recharge as well.
Great. Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and Co-Chair Gilliam and members of the committee. For the record, State Representative Bob Jensen from House District 58. I'm here to not speak specifically on this, but to introduce you, I think, to a telephone conversation that you'll be having with two of the gentlemen from the district and what they're the specifics of what they're asking for. I could just say it's a nice, simple little bill with only a couple of words in it, and half of those words are simply referring to the ORSs that you have where they go. So, but I will stay around for any questions that you might have if you'd like as you talk to J.R. Cook. And thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative. You're welcome to stay at the dais while we take phone testimony from J.R. Cook and anyone he has with him. Mr. Cook, do you hear us?
I do, Representative Cannon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Will it be just you, or do you have another?
Actually, the other individual copped out because he knows I'll take all 45 seconds.
Yeah. Well, I think we can give you a few more minutes than that, but if you keep your testimony about three, four minutes, that would be great.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chairs Cannon, Gilliam, and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is J.R. Cook, and I am the Executive Director of the Umatilla Basin Water Commission. As Representative Jensen stated, the commission is an intergovernmental agreement authorized by Oregon Revised Statute and consisting of representatives from the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation, Umatilla County, Morrill County, Westland Irrigation District. We formed specifically to implement the Umatilla Basin Aquifer Restoration Project, supported by Governor Kulongoski. The last two legislative sessions, the legislature and multiple state agencies and stakeholders. And today, I'm not speaking just on behalf of the Umatilla Basin Water Commission, but also the Umatilla Basin Water Coalition, who formed prior to the commission and actually recommended the formation of the commission. And that coalition is a lot larger, broader-based interest group in the basin. It consists of six districts, two counties, two ports, an electric co-op, and also the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. So I'm wearing two hats today. Both of the entities that I'm representing today have provided written support for House Bill 2134 into the record. So I was actually planning to be even more brief than 3 or 4 minutes, so I might get you ahead of schedule here. But basically, the written testimony can do a lot better than I can verbally. But I'm going to touch on a couple of really important issues. And the first issue, I should say, that resulted in the support for this bill is House Bill 2134 addresses an issue that we actually identified 2 years ago during the feasibility level study of our aquifer restoration project, and that that issue potentially could preclude us from applying for exchanges of water to recharge, even if those exchanges were the best possible way to meet water demands in our four designated critical groundwater areas, as well as improve our groundwater and surface water quality and quantity. And that's a big issue, and OWRD took the bull by the horns and took the initiative to address this issue and develop House Bill 2134. Even more important, I believe, than just the application of the bill and the passage of the bill itself is the development of House Bill 2134 and how the process of the development of that language exemplifies the reason why a restoration project is considered a model for the state of Oregon. While the legislative concept itself originated through OWRD, it took significant collaboration between state and Umatilla Basin stakeholders to ensure that the language meets the goals set internally and by law for the Umatilla Basin, including protection of flow targets in the Umatilla River, protection of existing water rights holders, and also addressing the interests of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. As the letter supplied much more valuable testimony in support of 2134, I'm going to close with just a couple of comments. And the first comment is that I believe OWRD should be commended for their continuing efforts to work collaboratively with all basin stakeholders to seek comprehensive solutions to our water supply issues. And secondly, I apologize for not being there in person today, but I thought this committee would like to know that today is our last day of actually testing stage one of the Umatilla Basin Aquifer Restoration Project, so I actually had to be here in person to turn a valve off and wait till October 1st of next year when we can kick on for a full recharge season. Really appreciate the opportunity, or I again continue to appreciate the efforts of the Water Resources Department and this legislature to work with this basin on truly a model for the state of Oregon and really the western United States, how we can deal with our water supply problems collaboratively and comprehensively. And I appreciate the opportunity from the co-chairs and members of the committee to testify in support of House Bill 2134 by telephone today. And I'll answer any questions you may have of the project or 2134.
Thank you, Mr. Cook, for your testimony. Appreciate the work that you're doing, the collaborative nature of it, and the success that you're already experiencing with that project. Sorry, personally, that I can't be out for the event this Saturday, but look forward to seeing it in person maybe before the year is out. We'll see if there are any questions for Representative Jensen or Mr. Cook. Well, they're not. JR, you can go back to watching or listening online, and we will move to our next panel. Thanks.
Thank you.
So Brenda Bateman from the department, why don't you come on up, and we'll have Craig Campbell and Leo Stewart as well. Katie Fast, you're on deck, and then we'll move on.
Ready to go to the city. Ask if they want to see
because
they're tough
and move the bill. I've done that more than once.
Brenda.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with Oregon Water Resources Department. Thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 2134 to you this afternoon, and we are indeed looking at the -3 amendments that were mentioned earlier. We'll move right into it. As you heard from Representative Jensen and Mr. Cook, this concept is part of a bigger project, one that you're very familiar with, the Umatilla Basin Aquifer Recovery Project. And the goal there is to improve water supplies in the Umatilla Basin because of the critical groundwater areas that are in place there. Having identified two of some of the best groundwater recharge sites in the basin, the whole purpose of this bill is to get water onto these locations at the lowest possible cost while maintaining existing protections that are in place. So if you'll indulge me, I just wanted to walk through your map a little bit. There's testimony there, written testimony with a map on the back. If you want to get that out and mark it up, please feel free to do that. This is one of those concepts that's definitely better in pictures than with words. So we wanted to describe just a little bit about what's going on here and the conundrum we face today. County Line Water Improvement District is using water today from the Umatilla River, and that's authorized under a water rights certificate. Water has been used there since the 1970s to operate a groundwater recharge project, and that water is delivered today from the Umatilla River, keep your eye on the blue ball, up through the Westland Canal system and up to County Line Water Improvement District. I apologize for my rudimentary graphics, but at least you get an idea of how water moves today. And once there, it is recharged into the groundwater system. So the folks at Echo Meadows, and there's a red box there on your screen that should be blinking, would like to do something very similar. But they are not likely to get a new water right out of the Umatilla River today because of available water. And so they will likely have to get their water in a new water right permit from the Columbia River. There's infrastructure in place already today that they can make use of. There are two places that they could use. One would be something called the CID Canal, and the other would be a route coming from Boardman Tree Farm. They use the same point of diversion on the Columbia River, and again, if you keep your eye on the ball, water would come down something akin to that infrastructure or maybe something parallel to it, and tends to stop right about there. That's where the infrastructure ends. So the whole intent of this bill is to look at how to get water the rest of the way into Echo Meadows. Recall that we're trying to get the water from where the blue dot has stopped into the red box, which is all the way on the other side of the screen. Today, that would entail constructing, operating, and maintaining a new multimillion-dollar pipeline. And so the whole crux of this bill, and I'll play it again, is for the basin to avoid having to construct and maintain this pipeline that would come across the rest of the way. Note that today, County Line Water Improvement District is closer to the Columbia River than is Echo Meadows, and Echo Meadows is closer to the Umatilla River. So the idea here would be for them to exchange water in equal amounts, keep everything even, and just bring water the rest of the way from where it stops today into both of those properties. Today, exchanges of this sort are allowed in statute, but it requires both parties to hold a certificate. In this type of situation that we're talking about, one would be holding a certificate, one would be holding a new water right permit. And so that's the permission that we're asking for as part of this bill, to allow the permittee to participate in such an exchange as well. There's another important consideration that's part of all of this. Now that we would have two properties placing recharge water there, where today we only have one, because of the geology of the area, both of those properties would be providing return flows that benefit the Umatilla River. So despite the fact that they come from two different water sources, their return flows would be moving towards and benefiting the Umatilla River. I wanted to walk you through just briefly the proposed language in the Dash 3 amendments, which I know are brand new this morning. You probably haven't had a chance to look at them. There are a couple of important pieces that I wanted to point out because I think that's really helped the stakeholders and partners with their comfort level with this bill. The first is to specifically confirm that we're talking about those who are holding permits, that this would be for recharges of groundwater, and that it would be specifically narrowed to the Umatilla Basin. The original bill was broader in scope. This would bring the location down to the Umatilla Basin. And the other important piece of this, and I think other partners may be speaking to this a bit later, is a paragraph that's been added to the very end of the bill, or at the end of the Dash 3 proposed amendments, that talks about extra protections for the Umatilla River, that we want to make sure that as we do this, no more diversions are created today, and no greater amounts than they are today than they would be under an exchange. We talk about, in this very last paragraph, no net loss of flow. And by that, we're comparing the current scenario with an exchange scenario, keeping all conditions for withdrawal of water from the Umatilla River the same as they are today. A couple other points that we wanted to make. Already there are some protections that exist in statute and rule that should help guide us as we put an exchange like this together. First of all, it's really important to understand that we're talking about exchanging equal amounts of water, so that those amounts should be the same under an exchange than they are under today's scenario. Secondly, we talked about getting a new water right permit from the Columbia River. That would be secured by going through our Division 33 standards that provides limitations on period of withdrawal. Those same limitations would carry over into an exchange as well. And finally, just a note about public process. For both new water right applications and exchange programs, there's plenty of opportunity for the public to input and participate in what's going on. My last screen here is about protections that we would specifically put into an exchange order. We have committed to a series of protections with our partners and wanted to put those on the record today. So very briefly, we protect in-stream flows in the Umatilla River today. Those would continue forward under an exchange. Secondly, as you may imagine, making sure this exchange is equal and, as we've described it, measurement and reporting is going to be a very important part of this. And so we're committed to that under the exchange as well. And finally, we'll need to have some provision in there in case an exchange comes to a conclusion. In that case, the permittees would have the typical 5 years to develop water rights for lands that were identified in the original permit or else face cancellation. So those are some protections and sideboards we wanted to make sure were on the record for you this afternoon. I believe that's all I have, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Thanks, Brenda. Let's hear from the other panelists. Mr. Stewart.
Thank you, co-chair and co-chairs and members. My name is Leo Stewart. I'm the vice chairman of the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation. I want to express the tribe's appreciation for the hard work of the Oregon Water Resource Department under the leadership of Director Phil Ward and the Umatilla Basin Water Commission to address CTR's concerns about this legislation. While the CTR supports aquifer recharge in the Umatilla basins, we would not do so at the expense of the Umatilla River flows needed to support our salmon, to restore our salmon fisheries. We have worked hard closely with the Water Resource Department and the Umatilla Basin Water Commission to revise House Bill 2134 to require an applicant for an exchange to demonstrate that the exchange will cause no net loss to the Umatilla flows. This requirement is now set forth in Section 4C of the bill. We have also been assured that this is no net loss definition and other protections would be included by the department in conditions to any exchange order allowed under this legislation. We appreciate the patience of the Water Resources Department and the Umatilla Basin Water Commission in working with us to modify House Bill 2134 and make sure it has the safeguards needed to protect the water users in the basin. And we are pleased to support this bill. We want to thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, again, I'm Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of Umatilla Electric Cooperative. I apologize that I don't have any graphics with bouncing balls. I'll try to bring that up next time I come forward. I do want to tell you that, first I want to start by thanking the Water Resources Department for the Umatilla Basin Aquifer Recovery Project. They have been fantastic partners through a very long process of getting things going, and I want to thank them for bringing forward this particular bill. It solves an unnecessarily expensive problem, and it enhances the economic efficiency of the project. And the other thing that's been fairly important to us, the way this project works is the conditions for withdrawing water are held constant, but it adds for the potential of additional return flows to the Umatilla. And because of the way that aquifer project works, that water comes back cleaner and cooler, so it's better for the fish when it does arrive. So with that, I'd like to indicate our support of the -3 amendments and thank the committee for taking it under their consideration.
Thank you. Any questions? There are none. Thank you very much. Appreciate
your
testimony. Katie Fass, you are last on the list. And members, our intention would be to move into a work session. We have the paperwork. If the votes are there, that's what we'll do. Katie.
Good afternoon, Chair Cannon and members of the committee. I will be brief. Oregon Farm Bureau supports the Dash 3 amendments and look forward to your support.
Great. Thank you. Sometimes the less is said, the better.
Wow.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2134 and open a work session on House Bill 2134. We have amendments. We have a fiscal and revenue impact statement to those amendments. There are no fiscal or revenue impacts to this bill. And I would accept the motion, Representative Krieger.
Yeah, do you want to move the Dash 3s then into House Bill 2134?
Make that motion.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2134. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Krieger?
Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2134 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2134 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Sue, will you call the roll?
We have Jessen carry it.
Representative Bailey.
Excuse me.
Representative Dunn?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Co-Chair Cannon?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2134 will go to the floor. Representative Jensen will carry the bill, I expect. We'll designate it that way anyhow. So once in a great while, committee, we do what committees are supposed to do. We work with that. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2134. Thanks to the department, the stakeholders, producing once again a win-win solution for the good work going on in the Umatilla Basin. With that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3623. We do have folks signed up to testify. We're going to take brief testimony on this bill. This is the kind of substance of this bill was imported from a bill we heard earlier in the session related to the Deschutes mitigation project. So we've heard extensive testimony, committee, already on this subject. That it's now been imported or proposed to be imported into 3623. We're looking at amendments that we'll hear about. So let's begin with Representative Wisnett. If we can round him up, that would be terrific. And we may need to stand at ease to do so. Okay. So we'll... Sorry, I didn't anticipate that. Bring him. Let's call him up. We'll stand at ease. Let Thank you, Representative Wisnett. We'll proceed with the public hearing on House Bill 3623. I just noted that we've had substantial testimony already on this Deschutes project, mitigation project, and some of the substance of that previous bill has been imported into, or is proposed to be imported into this bill. I'll leave the rest to you and the other folks who are here with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. And Mr. Committee Chair, as you stated, we had very good testimony. I thought at the first public hearing we had on this bill. And since then, we've been, I think we made our, we tried to convince with the testimony of the experts that are, does not include me, that we've increased the flow in the Deschutes River with this plan. I think everyone agrees that the plan has been successful and that we need to continue the plan. Since then, we've been working with all the interested parties. Main players are Water Watch, Water for Life, and the Water Resource Commission, and trying to find language that will satisfy all, that we're trying to be sure that we protect the habitat in the river and the river and provide adequate water resources to Central Oregon. And that's what the bill has accomplished. We had so many changes. The original bill that you had some money into it that we realized during this session is not going to occur. So we changed that and had some other amendments, and that's why we decided to go with the new bill number 3623 and put all the amendments in there. We came up with a short, sweet an amendment that said no sunset, but we would continue to have Water Resource evaluate the program every 5 years, report back on issues. We put language in there to protect water rights of people, and we did not address the cap. We left the cap as it was. Since then, there's been other drafts. Water Watch brought forth an amendment that I don't know if the chair and the committee members have had and seen, but it had some changes in there that yesterday I met with Water Resource Dr. Bateman. And the problem with that, and I expressed that to Mr. Myron, that the physical and financial impact of the things that Water Watch was asking for, I believe, would kill the bill, kill the program, and I don't think that's what anyone wants. So, Mr. Chair and committee members, again, thank you for hearing this very important bill to Central Oregon. I think that you're going to hear some more testimony said by the experts. And we need this bill. Central Oregon needs this bill. And it's been a very successful program. And we really urge the committee to give us some, maybe carry this over so we can decide which amendment we're going to go with. Because what we're trying to do is provide the committee, here's one proposal that came from us that we think is minimum financial impact. Here's one from Water Watch. And the resource department will tell you that for them to comply with that is going to be a big financial impact. And so we'll have to decide how to go on that. So I'm available for questions, realizing that there's a lot more expertise on this issue behind me. My role is trying to facilitate a good bill, good policy that will not cost the citizens of Oregon any more money, but also assure the safety and the well-being of the river and the people using the river.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. Any questions? Representative Krieger.
Just maybe to say, Mr. Chair, it seemed like there was they needed a commitment for certainty in that basin. And I heard over and over their determination and dedication to a process where they didn't really mind being monitored or looked at, but that was needed and the certainty needed to be there. And they've already been in the process. I can't remember how long they've been involved in it already, but it appears they're very much committed to it. And if you have the monitoring there from the Department of Water Resources, I can't see why we wouldn't move ahead with it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, you amaze me. You're recollection of the what was stated, and that was one of our main concerns, and that's why we came back to be sure the sunset was removed for the stability and to give some assurance to people that want to move into Central Oregon for business and also the cities that we do not have the sunset. But thank you very much for bringing that up. That was our intent, as you heard from testimony from the counties and the cities in Central Oregon.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
Let's hear next from Patrick Griffiths, Doug Riggs. Brenda, why don't you come on back up as well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Central Oregon cities, which is all nine cities, and Deschutes, Crook, and Jefferson County, plus Maupin, so we actually have a small part of Wasco County as well. Again, I really appreciate you taking the time. I will be brief because you've heard testimony on this. You've also, several of you were here in 2005 when we came through on the same issue. I've handed out a chart, which your staff was going to be bringing around, that I was asked by the committee to put together, that outlines on the left side the various issues that were raised in objection of the bill during the first hearing, where it is in the bill, the section of the bill, the objection, specific objection, and then on the right side it lists how we dealt with those. First of all, I want to say that we decided to split the bill into both 2867 and 3263 because it became clear that 2867 was going to have a fiscal because it allocated $2.5 million in lottery bonds, and in this session that might be problematic. So we decided to keep that as 2867 and then clean up in a new bill, the priority bill, 3623, without any fiscal, just simply reauthorizing the program. So I'll just read through relatively quickly the various issues. The main issue for us is a permanent reauthorization of the program. This has been a program that has worked. It has been handicapped by a time limitation, which has driven speculation in the basin and limited the ability to get all the participants in the basin to contribute water into the middle of the chutes. So we think that permanently reauthorizing the program leaves all the existing protections in the rules and the existing statutes, does not undermine any existing statutes, but allows us that certainty. The second issue raised by some of the interest groups was the definition of which water banks or which groups would be eligible for funding. We had long discussions about redefining the banks, limiting the banks to just the Deschutes River Conservancy or just the irrigation districts. We finally decided just to remove the language, and so we've removed that language in Section 2. There was a concern raised that cities might use funding allocated by the bill to meet both state statutes and federal statutes. We had a long discussion on that internally and decided to remove that language. So that's the second portion that we removed. Section 5 raised a number of concerns. It was probably the section that led to most of the emails that you received from your constituents and others. It was not the intent to undermine the Scenic Waterway Act in any way, shape, or form. We do not think that the department would ever have done so. But be that as it may, we decided to remove Section 5 in its entirety, just to clarify that that is not our intention. So the next section also applies to that. So we removed, significant portions of the bill. A couple of groups talked about specific issues in the shoulder months. We had that long discussion on that issue. We talked about the impact of groundwater withdrawals in the March timeframe and October-November timeframe. Although that's less than 1%, according to the models, we did stick language in House Bill 3623 in Section 2 that requires the department to take a look at that every 5 years and provide a report back to the legislature, and we've talked to the department about that the process. Concern was also expressed that the program might in some way, shape, or form injure junior users. We've had a long discussion with the department about that. We added language in the report requirement to address that issue. And then the last thing was the question about reducing flows, and this is a discussion that could go on for many hours and involve many scientific and technical witnesses, but I think what I'll say is that if you, and I've looked at the gauge readings, to this point, actual gauge readings do not show diminished flow. The models show, in some cases, diminished flow, but we are all committed in the basin to continuing to work with the department and with the other interests to make sure that we are actually protecting the Deschutes River. Remember, there are two goals of this bill. The first goal is to lift the moratorium that went in 1995 to allow existing water rights to be transferred among users so we could continue to have some economic opportunity. And the second key point was to get water back in the middle of Deschutes, and we have done both of those very well. So we are committed to the upper, the middle, and the lower Deschutes, and we remain eager to work with the parties in the basin. I've also handed out a bill from the Upper Deschutes River Coalition supporting 3623, and would submit that for the record. Thank you.
Thanks. Patrick, welcome back.
Thank you. Patrick Griffiths, Water Resources Coordinator for the City of Bend, member of the Central Oregon Cities organization as well, and Deschutes Water Alliance, and also a policy advisory group member for the water resources integration process. One quick thing, I want you to know that ODOT and the state troopers were managing water resources on the path today in the whiteout blizzard that I drove through, which you might not think about on April 14th. It was unbelievably like December up there today. Just so you know, you had two agencies helping out the Water Resources Department up there. Three accidents on the way over. It was quite a wild ride. I'm 25% of the original panel. I'm not going to repeat the testimony that we brought you before. I know you're very tight on time. I just want to reiterate one thing. This is a small but critical program to all the other things that we're doing in the basin. We're taking on the ESA, the Clean Water Act. Nobody's walking away from our scenic waterway responsibilities. We want to make this program work. We're going to continue to roll up our sleeves and work with the department and any stakeholders that are willing to do that with us. And with that, I'll move on.
Thanks, Mr. Brenda?
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department, and we're here this afternoon primarily to confirm the testimony that we brought with us in the last hearing on this topic. So you have that again before you, newly numbered, but confirming the points that we made before, which is primarily the Deschutes Mitigation Program works, in our opinion, and we would be comfortable having a sunset on that program removed and reporting on progress every 5 years as we do today. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Other questions? Seeing none, let's hear next from, thank you very much, Kimberly Priestley, Tom Wolfe, Bob Olson, you're up next, and Jonathan Manton, you're on deck.
For the record, my name is Kimberly Priestley, and I'm here representing Water Watch of Oregon. Our concerns with 3623 as drafted regarding the lifting of the sunset are largely the same as our testimony on 2867-1, so I won't go into that since it's already on the record. I did want to take a moment today to talk about House Bill 3623. I'm sorry. I forgot to address the chairs. I apologize. But I did want to take a moment to address the Dash 1 amendments that we had proposed. In sum, we think that these amendments provide a win-win-win solution. In a nutshell, they lift the cap, they lift the sunset permanently, which is what the bill proponents want, and that provides certainty to permit holders moving forward and water right users using moving forward. But at the same time, it provides a safety net that ensures that the outstanding problems, as identified in the 2009 report to the legislature, are fixed before the commission lifts the existing 200 CFS cap. And I wanted to take a minute to just talk about the certainty that this provides to the various interests. We heard loud and clear from the permit holders and users at the last hearing that they needed certainty. We think that this provides a very good path forward for them. Under our amendment, the idea is all the permit holders up to the 200 CFS cap could utilize the mitigation rules as they exist today. We have heard from some members, some user groups in the community, that they were worried about some of the permit holders who have incremental development of mitigation. In other words, like the City of Bend, the City of Prineville, they hold permits that they are not going to have to put their mitigation in place, you know, for 10, 20 years out. And we heard concerns that they thought that they would have to operate under new rules. The intent is that they would operate under the rules that exist today. And if that's something, you know, we are very happy to provide additional language that would address that specifically, that would ensure, you know, that it's clear in any bill amendments that they would have certainty moving forward. And I just wanted to reiterate a point that I stated last time, which is under the 200 CFS cap, all the major water users in Bend, water providers, have gotten their permits or gotten their applications in. So we're talking about, you know, all the big players. They've gotten their permits, so they will be protected under our amendment. Secondly, we heard from the Deschutes River Conservancy that they needed certainty moving forward in procuring mitigation credits, primarily permanent mitigation credits, and they felt that they needed the lifting of the sunset to achieve that. This gives them that certainty, and it also, because of the tie with the existing permit holders, you know, the mitigation procured and provided by the DRC is solid into the future under our amendments. There would be no risk whatsoever, and so we think that provision of the Dash 1 amendments provides them certainty as well. As for the river, our proposed amendment states under Section 3, I believe it's 3.2, that the Commission could not lift the 200 CFS cap that is currently in place until the state addressed the outstanding issues in the 2009 report in a manner that ensures that the impacts of groundwater pumping are offset. And I do want to clarify that point, because someone today said that folks were concerned with that language because they interpreted it to mean that we somehow want to put the onus on new groundwater users to restore flows. That's not what the standard says, nor what the intent is. The idea is simply to offset the impacts of these new groundwater permits. And the USGS model has shown, and the WRD models also corroborate this, that these impacts are year-round. Dealing with problems such as that, I think, would move the program forward in a way that provides certainty for all the major permit holders in the basin, the DRC, and rivers as we move forward. I did want to just address really quickly a couple points that some of the previous commenters made. The fiscal impact, we would be happy, I think that's readily fixed. We would be happy to provide amendments that would attach to Section 3.2 that are very similar to the language in another bill you're going to be hearing today, which is 2165, and it essentially says that before the state could move forward and do anything, that they would need to get either private or public funding. And, you know, we could lift the language exactly from that other bill if that made folks more comfortable. And sort of connected to that point is the fact that, you know, again, these water right holders, these are all the major users who would be protected under this amendment, and these water rights that they've gotten will provide their needs for decades to come. So we have ample time. It's not as if the state has to come up with the money right away to deal with these issues. There's ample time to deal with this in a thoughtful way under the Dash 1 amendments. And then I guess in closing, I just wanted to say there are Dash 2 amendments, and it just changed one word at the request of Water for Life. And so when we say we ask for your support of Dash 1, it's Dash 1, Dash 2 are fine with us. And if you have any questions, we would be happy to answer them.
Thanks, Kimberly. Let's hear from the other folks up here.
Co-chairs Cannon, Gilliam, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf, chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. In your packet, you should have written testimony from us, and to keep this going and allow you guys to get out at 5, I'm not going to repeat this. I just want to say that Trout Unlimited, and I've been told by Bob Olson, who had to leave, that Northwest Steelheaders support the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments given by Water Watch. We think those are fair amendments, and we support them. So I'm not going to add any more, and that's my comments. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Manton. I'm testifying today on behalf of Friends of the Metolius. And we would support as well the Dash 1 and the Dash 2, but not the other amendments that have been proposed. And I want to just kind of make a couple of points here briefly, I understand. You know, my understanding of the amendments we're at so far is that we're really not at a win-win-win solution yet. The bill that was up before you, I think, when dealing with the Umatilla Basin, showed that stakeholders can come together and get to a solution. But there's a couple of reasons why we're not there yet on the prior amendments. The 2009 Water Resources Report did identify many problems with the mitigation program as it exists today. It is working in some ways, but I would respectfully ask that the committee members go back and look exactly at what the department said in that 2009 report, because what's being talked about now does not address those problems, and many of them. And one I'll just mention in particular is this notion of the zones of impact. And those of us who care very deeply about the Metolius are very concerned that if we just extend this sunset provisions without addressing a problem like the zone of impact, that we may be looking at negative consequences to the Metolius. We're definitely not there yet. We would like to continue to work to get there on something that we can all come to agreement on, because we don't want to see, and I want to be very, very clear about this, no one that I've spoken with on this issue wants to see the mitigation program end. We do understand the need for certainty. We want to keep the parts that are working. We don't want the program to end with its current sunset. However, just kicking the ball down the road and saying, oh, we're going to report back on these issues that have already been identified, doesn't actually solve the problem. The department has identified these issues, and we hope that we'll actually try to work on solving those issues instead of saying that, oh, we're just going to take the sunset for 5 or 10 or however many years down the road and not actually solve the problem if it gets reported. But what good is a report that comes back if we don't actually go about solving the problems that are in it? So I just hope that you take those comments into consideration, and thank you very much for your work on this, and we hope we can get to something we can all agree to.
Great. Thanks, John. Any questions? There are none. So, with that, we will close the...
Mr. Chair.
Doug, very briefly.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful if the committee had the opportunity to hear the department's perspective on the amendments that have been offered, if you would allow that. We've gone through that with the department. There are some workability issues with the Dash 1, so if not, we can do it on the next hearing, but... I had prepped them or asked them to be able to answer a few questions on that.
So the department has submitted their testimony. I'd encourage, we've got Brenda's written comments on the record. Encourage her to be in touch with the committee with additional thoughts on particular amendments. I feel like we're still in such flux around these amendments. Happy to hear that, but not sure that we know precisely where we're headed yet. So be interested in your input in follow-up. Thanks, Doug. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3620, or that was a public hearing on House Bill 3623. We'll carry over the work session to Tuesday. So possible work session on House Bill 3623 carried over to Tuesday. Members, we need the co-chair here to move into work session. We'll do at least one work session before we depart. So with that, I'm going to stand at ease and await the co-chair so we can move into work session if it is his pleasure to do so. So the committee will stand at ease. And with the co-chair's assent, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2622, and we'll need a motion on the Dash 3 amendments. Representative Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2622, dated...
Ooh, someone pull them up.
Dated 4-12-11.
Representative Gilliam moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2622, dated 4-12-11. Is there discussion? Is there objection? So moved. Representative Gilliam, this bill does not have, we have the paperwork, no fiscal, no revenue, or minimal fiscal, no revenue impact, so this bill is scheduled to go to the floor. Do you want to make a motion?
Well, then, Mr. Chair, I therefore move House Bill 2622 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gilliam moves House Bill 2622 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, Sue, will you call the roll?
Representative
Gilliam. Excused.
Representative
Benz?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Wynn?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Co-Chair Cannon?
Aye. Motion carries, and 2622 to the floor. Is there someone to carry this bill? The original bill, we did a gut and stuff on this, so actually I think that probably isn't relevant, although he might enjoy the surprise of a bill that he hasn't tracked at all, but we've gotten stuffed as original.
I was thinking that, right? We need to surprise him more often.
Well, it's just, he's so articulate in committee, and can anybody explain why he mumbles on the floor when he carries? Have you noticed this? So I don't know. He's fine with me if everybody else is okay with
it. To give it to Shafley?
Yeah.
We have had no involvement with this bill.
We have volunteers.
I will do it if you want.
Representative Boone will carry House Bill 2622 to the floor. Thank you, Representative. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2622.
Mr. Chair, I'll have the questions for.
Not in advance, of course. And we will open a work session on House Bill 3109. Representative Gilliam, do you have a motion?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3109, dated 4-12-11.
Representative Gilliam moves the Dash 3 amendments of House Bill 3109, dated 4-12-11. Is there discussion? And I'll just confirm with you, Representative, these are the amendments that were supported by Mr. Honeycutt, I think, in his testimony on that bill.
Yes. Is that correct? I believe that is correct, sir.
That is my recollection as well. Seeing no further discussion, is there objection to moving in the Dash 3 amendments to this bill? There is not. So moved. And Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 3109 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Gilliam moves House Bill 3109 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion? Representative Benz.
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair, I will support the motion. I have serious concerns about the cost of the program reflected in the bill.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
I would say that it is to supplement all of the administrative rules, bureaucracy that are coming out of our natural resource agencies. So now they want to turn around and try to compensate us with something we do because we're good stewards of the land. I'll be a no on the bill.
Is there other discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I just note that there's a wide discrepancy or a wide range of potential work to be done on this project.
Thank you. I'll give the last word to my co-chair if he wants it. I appreciate the model of this bill, which attempts to provide alternative, non-regulatory, lower-cost approaches to solving environmental challenges. And we heard about that great example from Washington County where rather than spending some many millions of dollars to treat water. They did riparian restoration for a fraction of the cost to achieve the same outcome. It's that kind of flexible approach to solving environmental challenges that I think we ought to be encouraging. I think we heard the word market-based associated with this bill, and I think that's not at all wrong, and it ought to be embraced. I appreciate the leadership of Representative Gilliam, Representative Garrett, and others in continuing the process. I met with a group of students who were out here from the Yale College of Forestry all the way, you know, in New Haven, Connecticut, to Portland to come and spend a week in Oregon seeing what we're doing on ecosystem services, because this is the place where it is happening most effectively. So I hope that we will continue to move forward with this. I am daunted by the fiscal, but hopeful that we can work with LFO, the agencies, and the Ways and Means staff to find a way to bring that down and move forward. Any thoughts, Representative Gilliam, before we
do? Mr. Co-Chair, thank you for those comments, and I want to be sure that Representative Bentz and Representative Witt and my Vice Chair Krieger understand how much I appreciate their wisdom and their caution if, in fact, opposition to this bill. I would say this. There are very few opportunities where diverse opinions and corners of this building try to come together. In this case, I would say those who are interested in development and those who are interested in classic environmental issues come together to find creative solutions to how we can move forward instead of how we can block one another or how we end up in court. Those comments that I just made do not wipe out the fiscal, or I don't agree with the fiscal, but certainly there is one, and that's why we're sending it to Ways and Means. But there's a lot of work that's gone into this coming up to it, and there's a lot of work that's gone into this in the last few days to come up with amendments. And I appreciate members of the committee listening and for whatever level of support or non-support working to move this bill forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Seeing no further discussion, Sue, will you call the roll?
Representative Bailey.
Excused.
Representative Bentz.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
No.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger?
No.
Co-Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Co-Chair Cannon?
Aye. The motion carries, and 3109 goes off to Ways and Means. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3109. We have one more carryover. So we're going to carry over House Bill, the possible work session on House Bill 2196 to Tuesday. And before I close the committee, I will just confirm with the folks on my right and left that we're in proper shape. I think we've carried over.
Yeah. Is he married?
Yeah.
You were looking at him before we Liz thinks we've carried everything over except the old issue.
If we've carried him over properly.
That's wrong. Okay. With that, we will adjourn the committee for today. Thank you, members.
It is.